Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as a tour of the battle space of the war for the free world. One of the great comrades in arms in that war is our first guest and regular feature at this moment in our week, Fred Grandy, senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy for National Security Affairs and a man with deep experience on matters involving Congress, having served in it for four terms, and the Fourth Estate covering it, notably as a talk radio show host. Fred, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you, sir.
Where to begin? Shall we start with North Korea, the crisis that just keeps ratcheting up, it seems? What do you make of it, and why is this upon us?
Well, I think it's upon us because you've got a new leader in North Korea who has essentially been isolated and tutored by his grandfather and his father, and I think is trying to prove himself in a way. But I think he knows enough of the world right now, Frank, to look at American resolve, particularly as it regards national security, foreign policy, and denuclearization, and saying, why not push the envelope a little bit? It's a good way to establish what you might consider his bona fides as a national leader, but I also think he is, to some degree, the advance guard of more than a few rogue states that just want to see how far the United States will allow to be pushed. And so, you know, a lot of people think this kid is crazy, and I'm not so sure they're not right, but I think he's crazy in a very cunning way, and that's what bothers me the most. The thing that troubles me the most about all of this is pulling all of those South Korean workers out of Kaesong. That is something that I did not think would happen, and now that it has happened, I'm a lot more worried than I was.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting in talking with Dean Chang earlier this week, Fred, we established, Nick, of course, he's one of the leading experts on this subject now at the Heritage Foundation, that he thought that was perhaps as worrying a development as any, in that it suggests that maybe these guys really are preparing for war. And Fred, I completely agree with your analysis of this, that at least in part, it is a response to a sense of weakness and irresolution, and most especially the demise of the American nuclear deterrent under President Obama. And as we speak, there are reports now that the North Koreans are advising the Russians and other diplomats that they may wish to get out of Pyongyang, and that they are moving missiles, hiding mobile missiles in various places. All, again, very ominous stuff indeed, and perhaps completely unnecessary at a level of threat. Let me ask you, Fred, about speaking of threats, another joined at the hip with this North Korean regime, of course, are the Iranians. And their nuclear program is once again the subject of negotiations in Kazakhstan. What are your bookmaking odds on something useful coming out of this for us and for them?
Well, if I were an odds maker in Las Vegas, I wouldn't even bet on the United States on this one, because if past is prologue, the only thing the Iranians are doing by sitting at the table is buying time to complete the nuclearization process that is probably accelerating faster even than we know. I mean, you know, you have people talking about these negotiations and saying it looks like there's another lull in the negotiations. What we have is essentially nothing but a lull with negotiations in between. I mean, I don't know what the United States gets out of this other than just kind of more humiliation and embarrassment. And I also don't think, Frank, that there's a complete disconnect between what North Korea is doing and what Iran is doing. I think they're both in their own way testing United States' resolve, military and diplomatic. And they may not actually be conspiring, but I think they are kindred spirits in trying to just push and hunt and peck at what has happened to American resolve.
Yeah, very good point, Fred Grundy. And truth be told, it is a further reminder, the fact that we've got this this crisis on the Korean Peninsula in East Asia, and we've got an incipient crisis developing in the Persian Gulf with a nuclear-armed Iran, and the old idea that we might need to confront two challenges or perhaps even two wars simultaneously as a means of, you know, evaluating what our defense requirements are, having been overthrown by the Obama administration, seems to be very much back as a requirement today. Fred, on the Iranian bit, I just wonder whether you would agree that the buying of time is now so transparently the case that it really begs the question, is the administration seeking that outcome? In fact, giving the Iranians the time to get the bomb so that it can be presented with a fait accompli, and then they won't have to worry about it anymore. In that sense, try to do something about it at least.
That's a pretty grim prediction, but unfortunately, I think the facts line up behind it. I don't understand why this administration has always said we don't have to worry about them building the bomb; we just have to worry about them getting the bomb. What is the difference? I mean, and even after the trip to Israel, I don't feel any more confident that the president is lining up with our traditional allies, and is lining up with now our emerging adversaries.
Yeah, it sure seems that way. Speaking of emerging adversary, Fred Grundy, and again, Fred is the senior fellow at the Center for Security Policy for National Security Affairs and a former member of Congress and a star of stage and screen. Fred, one of the other threats that I think unquestionably has been abetted by the Obama administration is now coming, it seems, a bit a cropper in Egypt, namely the Muslim Brotherhood-led regime of Mohamed Morsi. What's the latest on that front, and where do you think it's likely to go?
Well, Morsi right now has his own domestic crisis on his hands because he can't feed his people. And this is a problem that I think the Muslim Brotherhood had an inkling of when they first took over, but were so, I think, bent on creating an Islamic government that they did not pay attention to their own collapsing economy. But the bottom line here, Frank, is that there are food riots in Port Said and Cairo and elsewhere because Morsi, in an attempt to get the International Monetary Fund to pony up about $4.8 billion in loan guarantees, was told to cut subsidies. And, of course, Egypt is an entirely subsidized society for food and for energy and for things of that nature. And he did so and now has people rioting in the streets. So the Brotherhood's popularity is plummeting. But the real question for those of us on this side of the world, who in the past obviously have been subsidizers of this economy, is if we do nothing, where will he go next? Will Iran jump in? Will the Arab Emirates jump in? Will the Saudis jump in? Are we, to some degree, by not funding these operations, pushing them into the hands of our enemies, or will the Brotherhood collapse? That's still an open question, but right now, it's not unlike what happened to Anwar Sadat in 1977. He had food riots too, but his choice was to go right to the West and agree to meet with Israel, and eventually, of course, this led to the Camp David Accords.
Right. No sign of that in prospect at the moment, unfortunately.
No, not this time. Uh-huh.
Fred, let me ask you very quickly. We've only got about a minute left. Your thoughts on where we are on your old domain, Capitol Hill, with respect to this bid for comprehensive immigration reform, as it's called?
Well, I think we are we're repeating the past, sadly, Frank. This is looking eerily familiar to Simpson Mazzoli, which was, of course, designed to answer the questions of amnesty and enforcement. And, of course, we've got all of the amnesty and none of the enforcement. All of these worker programs or visa programs right now are essentially at the bowsprit of this legislation, and you hear virtually nothing about enforcement or at least oversight of the people who are here already.
Fred, we've got to let you go at this, I'm afraid. We've actually had Chuck Schumer say, one of the Gang of Eight members, we're going to do the legalization bit first, and we're going to do the border security second. A formula for disaster, I'm afraid. Fred Grandy, thank you so much, as always, for your oversight of all of these matters and for joining with us each week to talk about them. We'll look forward to doing so again next week. Next up, Roger Noriega with a curious tale of Hugo Chavez's successor in Venezuela channeling Dr. Doolittle. What on earth is up with that? Find out straight ahead.
We want to know what you think. Leave your comments at 1-800-332-7131.
This hurricane season, coastal residents in the southeast and the Gulf states are urged to prepare for the uncertain conditions they may encounter in the aftermath of a major storm and make their annual contingency plans. In addition to other emergency essentials, the American Red Cross and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security recommend residents keep a diversified emergency wallet that includes cash and traveler's checks. American Express traveler's checks provide an extra measure of financial safety and security. Keeping traveler's checks and a supply of cash in small bills offers storm victims payment options to make necessary purchases. Traveler's checks never expire, providing a secure payment method whenever emergencies occur, this year and in the future. Unlike cash, they're refundable if lost or stolen. American Express traveler's checks are available at banks, credit unions, and American Express travel service locations across the Gulf Coast and Southeast regions. For more information, please visit www.americanexpress.com/travelerschecks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit ShariaTheThreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at Amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're joined by Roger Noriega, our duty guy on Latin America and other parts of the Western Hemisphere of great interest to those of us following the national security portfolio. Roger is, of course, a former ambassador to the Organization of American States and former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs. Roger, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Thank you.
I want to start off by asking a question that is not rhetorical. I think this is actually how you've sort of characterized it in your piece at InterAmericanSecurityWatch.com. Is Nicolas Maduro, the successor chosen by both apparently Hugo Chavez and his Cuban puppet masters, channeling Dr. Doolittle? And if so, why?
It's interesting. Let's face it, we're not making this up. This is something that's really playing out in Venezuela in a campaign for snap elections that will be held on April 14th to choose Chavez's permanent successor. Nicolas Maduro is the candidate of the Chavista movement, and he's absolutely bombing on the campaign trail, coming off as a very lame, pale, pathetic imitation of Chavez. And Chavez was this bombastic guy with silly stories and all of that, but he was very intelligent. And Maduro's act I'm afraid, is concealing the fact that he is not particularly intelligent and he's just following a script dictated by Havana.
And specifically, this Dr. Doolittle bit, quickly?
Well, he said during a campaign stop this week that a little bird appeared to him, flew over his head, and he felt the presence of Chavez. And Chavez tweeted to him, I guess, in an unconventional way, that he wanted him to carry on the revolution.
And, and I understand that Maduro tweeted back. And, Roger, by virtue of your experience in the State Department and, of course, in places like the American Enterprise Institute, where you're currently a visiting fellow, you've been following closely this dynamic in Venezuela, the election now in the offing, the possibility of a fellow who is engaged in this kind of bizarre behavior, presumably to try to endear himself to the Venezuelan people in a way similar to that of Hugo Chavez. But is it working? And if not, does this make for a real race in this election that many had assumed was really kind of a lock for the Chavistas?
Well, the fix is usually in for the Chavista candidates because they control all of the institutions and particularly the electoral authorities, and there have been some evidence of fraud that's emerged fairly recently. But they have to mobilize voters. They do that with all of the instruments of the state to do that. They have to motivate their people, get them to the polls. And the question is, number one, will people be enthusiastic about going to the polls for this guy who's just not measuring up at all? And will the military steal the election for Cuba? There's a lot of nationalism in the military, and they're chafing under the role of the Cubans and in Maduro's campaign. And it's quite possible that they will say, let's sit this one out because we better stand a better chance with somebody who can try to get us out of this mess and run the country. So it's a wild card. I think this Maduro will probably still win the election. And so what does that tell you about the system there? It's not sustainable in the long run, though. The economic situation's a mess. The fiscal situation's unsustainable.
But let me make sure I understand what you've just said. The military is unhappy about the increasing intrusion into Venezuelan affairs, including presumably theirs, by the Cubans. And that was something that, of course, was engineered by and under Hugo Chavez and resulted, you've told us in the past, is producing this candidacy of Nicolas Maduro. But are you saying that they would intervene in some way to ensure that the Cuban selected puppet is not elected? Or are you saying that they'll hope to weather this particular candidacy and do better in the future?
But what I'm thinking, and this is a wild card, it's out there, is the possibility that the military will decide not to mobilize the vote in favor of Maduro because they may believe, first off, that why should they steal an election for their enemies? The second thing is, it may be such a transparent fraud because of the fact that Maduro is not motivating his voters at all, that it may be much closer contest, that they may not want to run the chance of that happening. Again, I still think that the Chavistas will pull it out. Maduro will win. But it's not the economic situation is not sustainable in the long run. So we have to keep our eye on that situation in an important country in South America.
Yeah, and it, just a last question on this topic. And it falls to the military in some significant way to ensure that people the machinery of the Chavistas translates into a turnout in the polls.
Well, Maduro's rival within Chavismo is Diosdado Cabello. He's a military man and is sort of carrying the brief for the military.
This is one of the narco-trafficking generals you've talked about?
Absolutely, and he's also president of the party. So Cabello, who is really an enemy of Havana's, at least they perceive him that way, and his feeling is mutual, may decide to sit it out.
And how is the opposition faring at the moment? Are they performing well?
I have to say, Enrique Capriles Radonsky, the candidate, has been very bold, very aggressive with Maduro. He's not treating him with the kid gloves as he treated Chavez, really. So that's emboldened the his base. And the question is, will there be those people, those 2 million Venezuelans who haven't voted in the last 10 years, will they say, look, this is my last chance to save the country, and will they come out? And they're, let's face it, those people have not been waiting 10 years to vote for Nicolas Maduro, the guy who talks to animals.
Yeah, let's hope so. Let me ask you, Roger Noriega, and again, he is currently a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, a former Assistant Secretary of State for Western Hemisphere Affairs, and the driving force behind a terrific resource, InterAmericanSecurityWatch.org. I had the opportunity to talk with a senior U.S. military officer recently in an off-the-record setting, and he spoke very, very forcefully about the role that U.S. Special Forces had played in helping turn things around in Colombia. And he described the very enthusiastic support that we now enjoy in Colombia among the people there, because they really feel they owe their country to such help. Does that sound right to you? And if so, is this a model for the kind of engagement that we should be doing more of in the region?
Well, Colombia was a different case, really, a country that had where the guerrillas were metastasizing into the urban centers, and this leftist insurrection was moving into the capital and causing more and more economic damage. And it is true, frankly, that the point of the spear on this were special forces led by General Charles Wilhelm at the time, way out ahead of everybody, who started to train these counter-narcotics battalions. And that preceded the famous Plan Colombia. And it was bold leadership. Wilhelm deserves a lot of credit for that. And, of course, our military performed terrifically and helped the Colombians turn that country around. Of course, the real story also is that the Colombians had to have a national commitment to win the war and to pony up more defense spending to do just that.
And remain engaged to see the thing through. Roger, very quickly, we've got about a minute left. Just an update, if you would, on how things are developing between the Argentine government and Pope Francis. Any developments on that front that are worth noting?
Well, President Kirchner was the first head of state received by Pope Francis. They had a very uncomfortable relationship while he was cardinal.
Because in Argentina.
In Argentina, because he criticized the materialism of that regime and the efforts of the regime to sort of stifle opposition. And then they led this campaign, which some Western media bought into, or U.S. media bought into, about against Francis, trying to smear him as a friend of the dictatorship. So that was pretty nasty stuff. And so they're going to have to do their penance, I'm afraid.
Penance indeed. Roger Noriega, we have to let you go. Thank you so much for joining us, as always, and for this update on the hemisphere. We'll keep an eye on it with you in the future. Keep up the good work. Next up, Bill Gertz will talk to us about Russian aggression in the Pacific. U.S. response. Straight ahead.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In the midst of escalating tensions on the Korean Peninsula, the United States has sensibly been beefing up its missile defenses in the region, lest North Korea's erratic regime decide to launch missiles at things we care about. Meanwhile, the Russians recently sent a long-range nuclear-capable backfire bomber to simulate strikes on two of our anti-missile assets in the region. This is but the latest in a series of such provocative Russian flights in recent months against U.S. targets overseas and here at home. The Obama administration's response is pretty troubling, too. Its feckless Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel is busy announcing still more cuts in our national security capabilities and launching new talks with Russia about curbing our missile defenses. Rewarding their bad behavior ensures there will be more of it. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish uncovers the dark side of revolution in the Middle East and the reason why Muslim countries are unable to dig themselves out of a cycle of revolution, political unrest, and tyranny. The constitutions of many Muslim countries state that Sharia law supersedes all other law, and that is why it has failed in providing a legal and political system where healthy democracy can flourish. In this dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive. In The Devil We Don't Know, human rights activist and Center for Security Policy fellow Noni Darwish answers the tough questions. Why the Arab Spring won't usher in freedom and democracy or a feminist movement. And how Israel will be threatened by the new wave of Islamism after the so-called Arab Spring. The Devil We Don't Know by Noni Darwish. It's available at Amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Effney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We're joined by Bill Gertz, as we are each week. He is our duty expert on what goes on inside the ring, the title of course, his superb and must-read column in the Washington Times. He is also a senior editor at the Washington Free Beacon, and a man we turn to most especially for an update on what is going on in North Korea at the moment and in the region more generally. Bill, welcome back. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
So North Korea is continuing, it appears, its provocative behavior. Give us the latest on what they're up to, Bill.
Well, this is, in a nutshell, this is kind of triggered by the February 12th underground nuclear test, which was their third, and which Pyongyang hoped would allow it to enter the club of nuclear weapon states. The U.S. said no, that they don't recognize that, and that set off this big rhetoric about attacking on the unprecedented threat to send nuclear missiles to the United States, which prompted the U.S. then to fly our strategic bombers as a demonstration of support for the South Koreans. The latest development is that the U.S. has activated its global missile defense shield in anticipation that the North Koreans could be conducting a potentially threatening intermediate-range missile test. This is the Musudong, which has a range of about 2,500 miles, enough to hit the island of Guam. So if they do test this in the backdrop of these threats to conduct missile attacks, there's probably a good chance we would take a shot at shooting that missile down.
Wow. Bill, one of the things that's been striking about this, of course, is the as I was talking about earlier in the program with Fred Grandy, it's against the backdrop of the deliberate weakening, as you have chronicled probably better than anybody, of America's nuclear deterrent. Do you think that that has had something to do with the steps that the North Koreans apparently feel emboldened to take at this point?
Certainly that's a factor. You know, I mean, strategically, the North Koreans can read the signals coming out of Washington. And those signals, as far as our nuclear deterrent goes, have all been signals of weakness. And as Don Rumsfeld used to say, you know, weakness is provocative. It provokes rogue states like North Korea, like Iran, into doing things that they normally wouldn't do. And all the messages, strategic messages, until these recent bomber flights have been, we want to get rid of all of our nuclear weapons. We're really not concerned about modernizing this aging arsenal. And certainly in the national security community, in the military community, we should be very concerned about the weakening of our strategic deterrent, and it definitely needs to be upgraded.
Bill, one of the other wild cards in all of this has been the Chinese, and there have been a couple of very interesting developments on their part, and I want you to talk about each of them. Let's start with your report that the Chinese seem to be massing forces on the North Korean border. What's that about, in your judgment,
sure.
And where does it lead?
Well, it's not exactly amassing, but it is a fairly significant troop mobilization in the northern provinces of China toward the border with North Korea. There have been large-scale troop mobilizations, basically a mechanized unit, some tank movements, and this has been categorized as a security measure. The Chinese fear that if the balloon goes up in North Korea, that a large exodus of refugees will come in. A secondary effect of that mobilization is to also send a subtle signal to Pyongyang that the Chinese military is willing to live up to its mutual defense treaty that it has with Pyongyang, and that is the close relations between the communist PLA and the North Korean People's Army.
So you don't see this, Bill Gertz, as in any way pressure on the regime. It's a signal of rather China standing with the North Korean government.
Yes, and in fact, you know, one of the indicators of that relationship is oil flows from China into North Korea, and there's been no disruption in that. In other words, the Chinese are not putting any pressure, despite some reports from there that Chinese have stepped up border inspections. The flow of oil and resources going into North Korea have continued unabated. So, yeah, clearly there's no pressure from China on the North Koreans.
And yet, one of the other things that I wanted to just get your take on, Bill Gertz, is something that you featured in your Inside the Ring column this week, namely the new Chinese ambassador to the United States has apparently made some rather remarkable statements concerning where he thinks they're going on North Korea, or where, more to the point, North Korea is going. Tell us about that.
Yes, there's a new ambassador from China to the United States. His name is Kai Tanquay, and he basically, according to cables disclosed by WikiLeaks, he has some very interesting positions. For example, he told the South Koreans back in 2009 that China believes that the North Korean regime will collapse 2 to 3 years after the death of Kim Jong-il, which happened in December of 2011. He also said that China supports reunification of Korea under the South. In other words, a democratic reunification over a communist regime. And the reason there is that the Chinese realize that North Korea is not an effective buffer any longer, which is one reason that the military in particular wanted to maintain the communist regime in Pyongyang in power. It's very interesting that he would say that, and it certainly it goes against the Chinese military viewpoint, which is that the relations between the Chinese and North Korean militaries is and has been as close as lips and teeth, as their military commentators like to say.
One of their colorful turns of phrase, indeed. And as they're baring their teeth, those North Koreans, it's important to understand whether the lips are in fact with them or moving elsewhere. Bill, let me turn to a slightly different but not unrelated subject. At the very moment that, as you say, we're seeing U.S. missile defenses both put on heightened alert and in increased in terms of deployments to the Western Pacific. We've had an extraordinary new military exercise by a Russian backfire bomber. Tell us about that and what you make of it.
Yeah, it's very significant. On February 26th and 27th, a Russian bomber called the Backfire, it's a Tu-22, conducted simulated cruise missile attacks on a U.S. Navy Aegis ship in the Pacific, a missile defense shooter, as well as a ground-based missile defense radar site in northern Japan. And this is coming against the backdrop of anticipated further concessions on the part of the Obama administration. They're getting ready to send National Security Advisor Tom Donilon to Moscow on the 15th of this month. And that's when Obama's much-criticized remark that he'll have more flexibility on missile defense after his last election is coming to pass. The administration has already canceled the SM-3 Block 2B, which is supposed to be the replacement for long-range interceptors in Europe. And now the Russians seem to be demanding more than just the cancellation of that program.
Yeah, a very ominous turn of developments, needless to say. The idea that the U.S. government would at this very moment do anything that would compromise our missile defenses, Bill Gertz, is kind of unbelievable. And yet, as you indicated, Bill, this is not the only thing that Chuck Hagel is doing that raises concerns. Tell us, if you would, quickly, Bill, about what he has said to the Pentagon personnel just in the past week about the prospect for additional cuts to be made.
Yes, he gave a speech at the National Defense University, his first major policy address, where he warned that more defense cuts were coming. It's clear that he is a liberal who does not support strong national defense, despite his claims to the contrary. It's clear that the military is taking the brunt of the major cuts that are being made by the Obama administration, and this is part of a clear policy by the president. He wants to take money from defense and use it for his domestic programs. And of course, this is coming at the worst possible time. It's coming at a time when the buildup of the 1980s is needs to be upgraded. All of those weapon systems are being worn out or becoming obsolete, and it's really the perfect storm for damaging our military capabilities across the board.
Yeah, and as you said, Bill Gertz, so well, quoting Donald Rumsfeld, weakness is provocative, and I think there can be no question that we're going to be exhibiting a lot more of it, and it will be provoking a lot more very bad behavior. Bill, thanks as always for joining us. It's great to talk with you. We'll do so again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Mark Langfan, a brilliant analyst of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the lessons he's taking from the Iron Dome. You're not going to want to miss this. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Do you see that doggy in the shelter?
Hi, I'm Buddy, the adorable puppy you adopted from the Humane Society.
Meow. I'm Whiskers, a fluffy kitty, just waiting for someone to love me.
When you adopt a pet, we hope your new furry friend will become a cherished member of your family. And as Buddy and Whiskers will tell you, the key to success is following the rules to love by.
Woof, that's right. Please give me food, water, and exercise every day. To stay healthy, I need the same kind of things you need.
Talk to me. I like hearing your voice.
You're my best friend. Please don't stay mad at me or lock me up as punishment. Remember, I'm probably going to live 10 to 15 years, so take care of me when I get old.
One day you'll need someone to take care of you, too.
A message from the Montgomery County Humane Society. Visit www.mchumane.org for the complete rules to love by.
You will be your best friend for life.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though.
Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, the Threat to America at amazon.com.
Hi, I'm Casey Kane. You would think that as NASCAR's 2004 Rookie of the Year, I get my biggest thrill driving fast. But it's off the racetrack that I get one of life's greatest rewards, helping others through volunteer service. Working with kids is one way that I try to make a difference. The first time I visited chronically ill children in the hospital, I found out just how rewarding volunteering could be. By giving a little of my time, it brightened their day. I was so inspired that I started my own foundation to help sick children and kids without an opportunity to have a better chance at life. Through volunteer service, you learn things about the people you're helping, and you find out a few things about yourself. Volunteering is a rush, just like taking the checkered flag. Go to volunteer.gov to find out what drives you.
This is President George W. Bush. USA Freedom Corps has a volunteer opportunity that's just right for you. Visit volunteer.gov. When you help your neighbor, you help your nation.
So what's the deal? You gonna get a job now or what?
Did you have to shoot anyone?
Why are you so distant? Are you not happy to see me?
No one knows what it's like to come back from Iraq or Afghanistan unless they were there. Join other veterans at communityofveterans.org, brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
To securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined by Mark Langfan, a truly brilliant analyst and observer and commentator about particularly the problems that Israel is confronting at the moment in a very dangerous, indeed increasingly dangerous environment. And, Mark, you have written brilliantly on the subject, most recently in connection with something called the Iron Dome and how it relates to the future of Israel. Talk to me a little bit, if you would, first about the Iron Dome, what it is and why it has proven important in Israel. And then we'll talk about the analysis or the metaphor that's been offered to broaden the image.
Well, what happened was, since 1978, the Israelis have been subject to the firing of what is known as a Katyusha rocket, which is really an old-style World War II Russian rocket that's a little bit taller than the size of a man, but 122 millimeters thick. So it's really not that thick, and it's very easy to smuggle. And a lot of times they don't fire them in racks on trucks. They fire them one by one. And so they've been firing these things at Israel from the south of Lebanon into the north of Israel since 1978. And what happened was when the peace process started, or really before the peace process started, Israel controlled Gaza, meaning Israel militarily controlled the checkpoints going in and Israel had military policing type control inside of Gaza. So none of these rockets were ever smuggled into the Gaza Strip before the peace process.
Right.
They might have been able to smuggle a gun in or a knife, but you couldn't really smuggle a Katyusha rocket. So what happens is the Israelis say, oh, well, we want to have peace and kumbaya.
This is under Ariel Sharon, long believed to be
before Ariel Sharon. Before Ariel Sharon, when what happened was when Peres and
Rabin.
Rabin.
Yeah.
And what happened, yeah, in 1993, and Israel effectively withdrew its internal security.
From Gaza.
From Gaza. And so what happened was, it's almost, if you will, Israel no longer had a police force, or for that matter, the FBI, couldn't get into Gaza and couldn't get into the apartment buildings in Gaza.
Yeah, and so the criminals took over. All right, flash forward, Mark, because what I want to get to the point.
They smuggled vests in and blew up the Israelis with bombs, and then they built a fence. And so when they built the fence, they couldn't smuggle the suicide bombers in, so they then smuggled these Katyusha rockets that they fired. And so all of a sudden, Israel had to come up with a solution, or they could never theoretically give up the West Bank. So a labor defense minister funded the initial Iron Dome in the early 2000s.
As an anti-rocket device. Okay.
Anti-rocket device, because these aren't really missiles.
Right.
Relatively
primitive.
These are sort of just smallish.
Mark, we got to move on here. Let's just get to the chase. The Iron Dome was developed and has proven to be highly effective against these kinds of missiles, or rockets, I should say, but they have been primarily aimed at relatively empty areas of Israel. And what we've learned is if a similar kind of threat were to be mounted from what's been called the West Bank, but is historically known as Judea and Samaria, the problem would be altogether different. You have made a career of developing and presenting and otherwise using a three-dimensional map to help explain why what is happening in Judea and Samaria is of such direct importance to the security of the people of Israel, the large population centers of Israel. Walk us through that quickly and this point that the member of Knesset made about Iron Dome in a sort of metaphorical sense.
Exactly. Well, first of all, the key is even though these Iron Dome has had good success against rockets, good success is relative, and still about 20% to 30% get through. But this is the key. It's one thing, if you're firing from Gaza, you're just firing one direction. So the rockets do relatively well when they're just being fired in one direction north. Also, as you said, the entire area around Gaza is almost empty, except for a couple of very, very relatively small cities. So it's like firing a rocket into North Dakota. You're almost really not going to hit much. But the key difference is the West Bank sits right next to 70% of Israel's population and 80% of her industrial base. And there are multiple vectors from which you could fire these rockets. So,
and there is high ground from which you can fire the
and
rockets.
And there is high ground. So it was almost, if you were able to intercept 80% from Gaza, that effective rate would go down to 20%. But even 20%, imagine if someone fired from Brooklyn into Manhattan 20 rockets and 10 and 2 got through. The key difference is when you're talking about the West Bank right across from Tel Aviv, you're talking about a population density that is similar to New York City.
Right.
So if you're firing a rocket into New York City, it doesn't matter where it's going to land. It's going to have tremendous killing impact. And when you couple that with the ineffectiveness of these rockets when fired from multiple directions simultaneously, it is going to degrade the effectiveness to virtually zero. And the additional killer is that Katyusha rockets carry chemical weapons. So,
when you say, let me just make sure I clarify this. When you say that the rockets are fired from multiple vectors, you're saying that the ability of Israel to defend against such attacks becomes much more problematic if they have that
kind of free ride
from the West Bank. All right, now let me reintroduce our guest. He is Mark Langfan. He is a writer. He's most recently written a marvelous piece in an Israeli publication entitled Judea and Samaria Are Our Iron Dome. And he has made the point very clearly. Art Shova is the publication. He has written a marvelous piece entitled Judea and Samaria Are Our Iron Dome. And talk very quickly, if you would, about Eilat Shaked, a member of the Knesset, and the analogy she's made between Iron Dome and this important high ground of Judea and Samaria.
The key problem is if Israel were to give up the West Bank to any kind of Palestinian quote-unquote demilitarized state, they'd be able to smuggle the same type of weapons that they smuggled into Gaza into the West Bank and fire them into the heavily, densely populated area. So Eilat Shaked just made what is really the first statement by an Israeli Knesset member where she is saying the only protection Tel Aviv has from Katyusha rockets is by keeping Judea and Samaria. In that, without Judea and Samaria is the shield for Tel Aviv. Without Judea and Samaria, there will be no Tel Aviv. Without Judea and Samaria, they will smuggle these rockets in and fire them the same way that they smuggled and fired these rockets. And the key distinction is when Fatah controlled the Gaza Strip and they fired the rockets. These rockets are so small that it only takes one or two terrorists to run outside and fire them and then run away. And they could do it very quickly. So it's very hard to police, if especially you really don't have a police force that cares about stopping these things to begin with.
Like the Palestinians would have. Mark, we're going to have to leave it at that. This is a tremendously important insight. And I think especially, as you say, were these rockets to be armed with chemical weapons and fired into densely populated areas of Israel, it would indeed be disastrous.
Keep up the good work. Fantastic, and God bless you.
Thank you so much for your great work, particularly this very important three-dimensional map. You can find out more about it, folks, at marklangfan.com. It is indispensable to understanding the importance of Judea and Samaria to the security of our friend and ally, the State of Israel. We'll look forward to talking with you again in the near future. We'll look forward to talking to the rest of you again next week, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.